institution operated by the Sisters of Providence. I don't speak for them particularly, but as myself, who happens to be a practicing Catholic, but who has cared for all levels of severely damaged children for a great number of years. In earlier times, and you can look at me and see I am representing earlier times, when I started, we didn't have penicillin, we didn't have sulfas, we didn't have all of these things.
And we don't look like you go back that far now.
That's right, that's right. We kept people pretty comfortable, even though we didn't have the present technology that was available. And people did, their nutritional status did deteriorate as they died, but we could keep them comfortable by nursing techniques that were not too imposing on us attending staff. And the other point I would like to make is that in my experience, a patient who's dying of natural causes, these life-sustaining feeding techniques really don't restore the patient. You don't restore this patient to anything that he was before, even nutritionally. All you do is let him chug along. And the other nausea and vomiting are so common that the tube, even in place, does not prevent aspiration pneumonias. We get gastric bleeding from the tubes themselves, and we've had, not uncommonly, we have some kind of a contamination with an abdominal wall infection as a result of that gastrostomy. So that actually we end up treating the complications that the artificial feeding has imposed on us. In the judgment that I'm inclined to make, I can honestly say that the quality of the child's future life is not relevant. In a responsive, though severely handicapped child, we would not question the use of artificial feeding if the discomfort involved in the swallowing indicates its use. And particularly, we use this as a means to get over the hump, to get onto oral feedings. In the dying child, when we aren't using this, we can maintain the child's hydration in simpler ways, keeping them comfortable until the natural process of death is over. It will not be easy, and maybe not even possible, for either me or the staff to withdraw the feeding tube from a completely comatose patient for whom we have cared for 9 years. He is a son of Maureen Lohr, who has addressed you earlier. However, with experience, we've learned to use techniques that we could feel that we would not be able, we would be able to provide some hydration, and we can attend any symptoms that he may, that may indicate he has some kind of a reflex discomfort. These methods have been used in the past, and they're appropriate. Our chief concern, therefore, is for the helpless dying patient, and with cure limits, defining the prognosis and with an instrument to strongly state the patient's wishes, the law can provide a humane and moral guide. Right. Thank you.
Doctor, thanks very much for being here. Dr. Robert Smith, please.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Robert Smith, and I've been in private practice of internal medicine for the past 20 years at Portland. I am here because of the concern mainly of my patients. I deal with a large number of geriatric patients, and death and dying has been a large part of my practice through the past 20 years. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 20 and 21. And I would like to just address the issue of the mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration. This bill would provide significant improvement over the previous statutes, and it is sorely needed for clarification purposes. We, at the present time, in the dying patient, are in a chaotic state with regard to intravenous fluids, and artificial abnormal feedings. It is very difficult for a patient to come into any hospital in an ill state these days without having an IV put in the first 15 to 30 minutes. If the patient does not eat within the next 12 hours or 24 hours, often a feeding tube goes down, no matter what the condition. As frequent as the intravenous feedings and feeding tubes are used, can you imagine how difficult it is to stop them? Currently, we can't. Food and hydration does not prevent death. I would like to address briefly the issue of comfort. Food and hydration in the patients that we're talking about does not afford comfort. Indeed, in many, many patients that I've seen, that all of us have seen through the years, artificial feeding and hydration promotes the agony of death. Many patients in a terminal state, for example, terminal cancer, may be in and out of lucidity, but they are in tremendous agony. They want to die, and they want to die in peace. Every hour or every minute that we sustain them is agony. This bill would not in any way promote euthanasia or allow suicide. It would allow a more specific, in-depth communication between the patient, the family, the clergy, and the physicians. I strongly support Senate Bills 20 and 21, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Smith. Is Senator Kintai here? All right, sir, come up, please.
For the record, I'm Bob Kintai, Senator from District 14. I have been receiving many calls opposing this bill from my constituents. To date, I have received none supporting these bills. I have several concerns with Senate Bill 20 and 21. First, we already have a living will statute. Additional legislation is redundant. But more importantly, Senate Bills 20 and 21 are so overly broad that they strip patients of their rights and transfer more power to physicians. For example, current law deals only with patients who will die relatively soon, regardless of treatment. However, Senate Bills 20 and 21 remove this criteria of terminal illness and imminent death. This enlarges the class of patients to individuals who would live a long time with treatment but would die quickly without treatment. This expansion can be used to authorize omissions which are equivalent to euthanasia. Senate Bills 21 power of attorney explicitly includes all kinds of patients, whether terminal or not. It also includes all life-sustaining means, including nutrition and hydration. Further abuse can arise from the vague phrase active and natural process of dying. This could apply to all living humans, or at least to senior citizens. I suggest we keep the current law and not allow Senate Bill 20 and 21 to come to the floor for a vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Hayden, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Cedric Hayden, State Representative from District 38. I'd like to share briefly with the committee some of my professional background so that they can see how I came to adopt some of the views that I will present today. I'm not a physician. However, I have been closely associated with hospitals over the last 30 years. As a blood bank technician, as an anesthesiologist, as an orderly, as a patient, as a parent or relative of patients, as a flying doctor, as a hospital dentist and as a hospital board member and as a resident. I've worked in civilian and military hospitals in Oregon, California, and overseas. My professional training includes degrees and residencies in anesthesiology, public health, and dentistry. I've been a member of the board of directors of the Western Oregon Health Systems Agency for 3 years. I've been a member of donor teams harvesting organs for transplants. During these 30 years, I have seen situations where people would die, even where life support systems would be removed. But I'm seeing something now that I've never seen before. I'm seeing the removal of life support systems for what appear to be economic reasons. The Hippocratic Oath binds doctors to preserve life, and when medical science was unable to prolong life artificially, the choices were not hard. They almost always fought hard to save the life. Now that technology has made it possible to preserve life in situations that would formerly result in quick death, the ethical choices are harder, but I am very uncomfortable that these would be made on economic decisions. We may cloak our actions here with all the euphemisms that we can muster about death with dignity and compassion for the family, but the truth is that we are considering shooting our wounded. These actions diminish the respect for life that we once held. They diminish the dignity and respect with which our senior citizens and elders should be held. They diminish respect for the power of the intellect and mind. The body may be crippled and broken, but as long as the mind works or can be restored to function, that individual should not be discarded. You will hear case after case of individuals who have aroused from coma after weeks or months. It's a foregone conclusion that if some of these bills are implemented, some lives will be terminated that could have been saved. Again, we will hear the economic argument. Can society afford to maintain all individuals at all costs on the off chance that 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 will recover? These are hard decisions. You have my sympathy in having to determine what is right in these situations. I'd like to go to your questions now. Should life-sustaining procedures include nutrition and hydration? Yes, in every case. I do not believe it is artificial or invasive to feed someone with a cup or a spoon or a tube, as long as the esophageal route is used. When we consider invasive procedures like gastrostomy or IV, these may be considered heroic measures and might be withdrawn. Should a person in the active and natural process of dying be permitted to determine when life-sustaining procedures shall be withdrawn? Yes, but not starvation under state auspices. Food and water should not be withdrawn. This country is rich enough and strong enough that we can afford food and water and a bed for every citizen as long as the heart beats. Should life-sustaining procedures be withdrawn from irreversibly comatose patients under certain circumstances? Life-sustaining procedures might be withdrawn from these patients under some circumstances, but not food or water. And of course, an EEG should be done in every situation. It would be, I believe, criminal to terminate a person who might be in a coma, but in a coma, as far as we know, we have no pain, the patient is comfortable, and if there is a chance that brain waves are present or might be restored, I believe that person should have the benefit of the doubt. In cases where a person is incapacitated and has not or cannot make their desires known, may the decision to withdraw life-sustaining procedures be made by others closely connected with a dying or comatose person? I think probably yes. The answer would be yes. I think these and perhaps other cases should be referred by an impartial third party. I think the medical record should be carefully reviewed as a necessary check and balance, perhaps by investigators of the State Board of Medical Examiners. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank both of you gentlemen for being here. Sue Anchorinka, we're not going to be having any demonstrations in here now. Thank you, gentlemen. Is Sue Anchorinka here, please? Come up, please. I hope I pronounced your name right. Is it close enough?
You pronounce it just fine, but my husband spells it wrong.
Oh.
Right. Thank you very much, Senator Fry and other members of the committee. My name is Sue Anchorinka, and I'm a critical care nurse, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bills 20 and 21. I did hand in a copy of my written testimony, and the first point I wanted to make is that I definitely support the inclusion of mechanical and the artificial provision of nutrition in the definition of life-sustaining procedures. And I have included details which I will not read here. They would be redundant. The next major point that I wanted to make is that with respect to the directive, I definitely like the revisions to the directive. I like the benefit-burden analysis in the revised directive because I believe it accommodates differing individual value systems which are represented here today. The benefit for one person as opposed to the burdens is going to be different for the benefit of another person as opposed to the burdens, and that kind of analysis will allow all of us in this room to give our own viewpoint for our own personal welfare of what we would like. My third major point is that I believe in Senate Bill 21, I would actually remove the warning on the printed form. It specifies that in a printed form for the durable power of attorney for healthcare matters, that there's a warning of what you're doing when you sign this document. That might sound a little drastic, and I frankly don't expect that you would actually do this, but let me explain why I would do it if it were totally my bill and I were not, you know, doing it just for myself. The purpose of a durable power of attorney for healthcare is to allow a person to designate an agent or a voice when he is unable to communicate because of unconsciousness or disorientation or unresponsiveness to surroundings. And the reason a warning is not necessary is that in establishing an attorney in fact for healthcare decisions, the principal isn't really delegating any exercisable right. When a person can't communicate, he still has a right to make healthcare decisions, but it's impossible for him to exercise that right. So that right is irrelevant unless he has ahead of time said to the person he trusts most to follow his own judgment, if I'm unconscious, I want you to be the one who says what I would want. And that's why I think that this should be a very simple matter. When you are, healthcare providers can't avoid making decisions. In critical illness, the patient either must be moved into the ICU or not be moved in. He either has to be resuscitated or not. You have to make that decision right now sometimes. Due process is irrelevant. You need some kind of guidance. You want to do what is important to that patient, and that patient is unconscious, and what are you going to do? You feel better about it if you know that that patient has designated someone, his own choice, who's designated. That's the whole point of the durable power of attorney. So you're not really signing away any rights with the durable power of attorney. You're only attempting to expand your own rights. It's merely a way of bringing more of the patient's voice to the decisions at hand when the decisions have to go on, but the voice has stopped speaking. And my final point is that I think that SB 21 puts an unnecessary emphasis on incompetence and incapacity as medically diagnosed concepts. For the purposes of SB 21, or a durable power of attorney for healthcare matters, I think that we need neither a medically diagnosed nor certainly not an adjudicated definition of incompetence. We merely need the common sense approach. Can this patient or the person who is for whom health care is contemplated, can that person express to the physician or the other health care providers what she or she wants? And if he can't, then the durable power of attorney in fact, goes into effect. If he can, then the patient maintains that right. Thank you.
What's your husband's given name?
Andrew.
What's his father's name?
Willis.
You're no relation to Garland Drzynka.
Well, I am.
Well, what is it?
He is my father-in-law's cousin, but I haven't met him yet.
Anybody with a name like Drzynka has got to be related to every other Drzynka in the whole world. There just aren't that many of them, are there? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, let's see here. Let's have Larry Copenhaver and Reese Johnson together, if we could. Are they both here? Reese Johnson here?
I don't know that he was going to come if I came.
If you were here, you didn't think he was going to be here. All right, fine. Now, listen, before you start, let me say, I'm going to try to remember to do this, I want to alert the following witnesses so that you can kind of get to the edge of your chairs and hot put it up here since we're, the testimony is limited in time. But the next witness I'll call will be Sharon Caldwell. Is Sharon Caldwell here? Okay. And then after that, I'll call up the Reverend Mr. Taylor. He's here. Okay, fine. And then Dr. Norris is here. Okay, that's kind of the way we'll start off. Go ahead, please.
Members of the committee and chair, my name is Lori Copenhaver, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the estate planning section of the Oregon State Bar. This section supports both of these measures in concept. As estate planners, members of the section are called upon to advise clients and their families who are concerned about potential incapacity and to plan for such an eventuality. A subject which often arises is the death with dignity legislation. Overwhelmingly, our clients desire to ensure that their wishes are respected with regard to the medical treatment in the event they are unable to make their own decisions. The section endorses the concept of the proposed legislation for the following reasons. Senate Bills 20 and 21 reaffirm a person's common law right of self-determination and constitutional right to privacy. The measures provide legally significant means for a person to participate in medical treatment decisions. The measures provide an alternative to court proceedings. Execution of the documents may serve to discourage lengthy and expensive court proceedings whereby the issue is often moot by the time it is resolved. Relaxed provisions under Senate Bill 20, the Living Will Statute, should tend to reduce the risk of an invalid directive due to failure to follow the strict statutory language now in existence. The section, however, suggests the following amendments to Senate Bill 21. First, that the attorney in fact be exonerated as long as he or she acts in good faith. The attorney in fact should be granted the same immunity as the attending physician. At a minimum, it should be clear that the attorney in fact is not liable for the principal's medical expenses. The attorney in fact should also be allowed to resign at any time rather than only while the principal retains capacity. The attorney, in fact, may at the time of the principal's incapacity be unwilling or unable to serve. We also suggest that the attorney, in fact, be given the authority to remove the attending physician if the attorney, in fact, determines the attending physician is not meeting the patient's directions. Also would recommend the change of the definition of incapacity to track what is currently found in the guardian statutes. As it now stands, by power of the virtue given to the attending physician to determine incapacity, the attending physician is given the right to determine when the attorney, in fact, becomes empowered to act. And finally, whether it needs to be reconsidered, whether the condition is needed that the witnesses must state they are not entitled to any part of the estate of the principal upon the death of the principal. This provision would include anyone who is a joint owner of property with the principal or a life insurance beneficiary. However, it can also be construed to include creditors of the principal's estate as well as his or her fiduciaries, i.e. the personal representatives or trustees, persons who are compensated for their services. Also, prior to testifying on this, I met with Diana Godwin, and she asked me to state that there is currently before the House Bill number 2296, which is much like Senate Bill 20, and that Senate Bill 21. The bar supports the provisions of Senate Bill 21 as they may override 2296. And she just asked me to state that and to testify on her behalf. Okay. Thank you very much.
Are you related to John?
No.
Okay. Do you have your amendments prepared in some written form? I'm not sure if I got that here.
Let me check.
What I got was the testimony from Theodore Falk, Karen Berry, and Diana Godwin. Was there?
Their amendments, Diana said that they'd be sending them down.
Okay, the amendments that you discussed?
That we discussed, those didn't come down. I'll have them to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Her testimony is in the book.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Your testimony is in the book. All right. Here, whatever you want to distribute, give it to the...
I'm just going to give you this to look at.
Well, give it to the clerk over there. She takes care of handing things out, if you don't mind.
Sorry. I just want you to know these are real people we're talking about, not theories and textbooks. So if you could, this is not submitted as testimony, you know...
You know, there's nothing you're saying that's getting on the record, because you have to sit by a microphone.
That's fine. If you could just show that to them, then that's procedural. Because those are two people, old people, in a home that their daughter suspects were starved to death.
Start by putting your name and mailing address on the record, will you please?
Okay, my name is Sharon Caldwell, and my address is Box 816, Newburgh, Oregon. And members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm a graphic artist who's recently shifted my work focus to graphic arts with an emphasis on communicating pro-family and pro-life issues by means of mass mailings. That's mailings, not nailings. This is the second time that I've been down here to give my opinion on this proposed legislation. The first time I gave testimony against this bill, it was called Senate Bill 812, and that was before the task force. I want you to know that I consider you people to be innocent bystanders as I am. So let's make that clear. However, depending on how you feel about it, you might not like me and you might not like my testimony, but I have to just tell you how I feel about it. When we set about to prepare testimony at hearings such as these, we want to appear intelligent, reasonable, and most of all, rational. We try to be tactful and non-offensive, and that's all well and good. And we're grateful to have the opportunity to voice our opinions to bodies such as these. The question is, when we take the time to come down and testify, will we be heard, or is it simply a formality? Will those who are drafting this legislation really listen, or will we, who oppose it, merely be tolerated as a necessary accompaniment to the completion of the work at hand? After reading over and analyzing the various transitional drafts that SB 20 has been through since 1985, I am convinced that no amount of so-called public testimony, protesting any portion of it, would have made any difference at all. For example, Draft J, the one before this one, considers anyone under 18 years of age to be incapacitated. When we got the final draft, that was lowered to teenagers of age 15. Draft J considers food to be a life-sustaining procedure, but not water. The final draft includes both food and water as life-sustaining procedures after all our testimony. And I might add, I have their working minutes, and they debated these things, and they are ignored in the final draft. Because these changes were such a blatant slap in the face to those who submitted testimony against this bill, I've concluded that it's not possible to be tactful, nor really necessary to be reasonable in voicing an opinion about this bill, because the people who put it together are neither rational nor intelligent. Shall we rationally plead for you not to pass a bill to starve old people to death in hospitals and children? The very idea of it is irrational. Now first, I'm sorry if I'm offending. It's hard to be unoffensive, but I am offended at being ignored. Now, first I want to voice my opinion in regard to the proponents of this legislation's use, and I want to underline that, of Mrs. Maureen Lohr and her son Jason's heartbreaking plight to make their point. I feel sorry for Mrs. Lohr. But I want to point out that in Afghanistan, little kids are getting their arms blown off every day, and legs. And their mothers are having to live with it, and we're sorry, but that's the way the world is. Everywhere they go, they haul this woman out, and they push her in front of the camera as their star witness. This is an obscenity, and the people who are doing this are obscene.
You've spoken for 5 minutes now, and
other people got to speak longer. I'd just like to make a couple more points, and I understand.
I'll give you one more minute.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Now, are we going to be able to watch this little boy's starvation on camera as well? I really doubt it. Can't they find any other examples, or are we going to use this one child's case to change the whole entire law in the state of Oregon that can affect thousands of people, men, women, children, grandmothers, and babies? Does that make sense? Secondly, I object to the use of the term public meeting for the 5 unpublicized meetings that were held last year. Ask anyone on the street in Portland what the term directive means, and you'll be met with a blank stare. These were token meetings, in my opinion, held to make this act of deceit, which is what this bill is, seem respectable and above board, and there's nothing has been said about it in the Oregonian, except for some articles that we initiated.
Your time is up. There are 21 other people who probably feel just like you do, or maybe close to
you. I know, but you have, honestly, Mr. Fry, you have let people speak for, you know, like a half an hour.
That's exactly right.
To indicate that as an indication of exactly what I'm saying.
If I let 22 people speak for half an hour each, we wouldn't be here all night.
Right, I understand that, but it's always the people